Okay, good morning, and thank you for joining us to discuss public financial management in conflict-affected countries. I am Raymond Gilpin, and I head the USIP's Center for Sustainable Economies. This morning, we want to have something a little different from usual. We're not going to have a panel that's going to make presentations, and we have general Q&A. What we want to have is a lot of dialogue about possibilities and strategies for the future, because one of the outcomes of this event will be a short brief that summarizes policy recommendations that would allow international partners like the United States to be a lot more effective in its interventions in conflict-affected states, and also to elevate the economic and financial side of state building, which I think has been undercovered and underrepresented for too long. Generally speaking, rebuilding state institutions and reviving economic activity in fragile and conflict-affected states remains one of the more difficult challenges facing policymakers and practitioners. Years of instability in these countries and sometimes violent conflict have led to a flight of capital, destruction of physical capital, and an erosion of human capital in most countries. And this makes the task of reconstruction even more problematic. Faced with the twin tasks of short-term stabilization and laying the foundation for longer-term sustainable growth in very trying circumstances, policymakers and practitioners need to think creatively about how best to allocate and utilize very scarce resources. The OECD's 2005 Paris Declaration and the more recent meeting in Accra in December 2008 highlights the importance of aid effectiveness in this context. It identifies internationally agreed initiatives that enhance the effectiveness of support from international partners like the United States. However, the improved aid effectiveness that we seek will have very, very minimal, if any, effects in these countries if they do not have the policies, institutions, and personnel to manage the finances effectively. This is why this morning's discussion is so important, because I believe that measures to improve aid effectiveness must be complemented by concomitant measures to improve public financial management in the countries that we so wish to assist. But as you would imagine, being able to identify the problem is the easy part. Even I can manage that. But more difficult questions linger, such as, where do you start in an environment that is so resource-strapped and that where every development challenge is a priority? How do you prioritize public financial management? What frameworks work best and where? How do you handle political will and governance issues, which are critical? Are conflict-affected states special? Do they require special arrangements in terms of public financial management? These are questions that I believe that we should be grappling with, and I'm very honored to have an excellent panel to help us think through these questions. Our discussions would, as I said, would be results-oriented, what has worked, and what general principles could we glean. On the panel today, we have four excellent and experienced professionals. And you have their bios. If you don't have their bios, you could pick them up on the table on the way out. But even though you'll be able to read the extensive bios, I'll just say a little bit about each of the speakers in the order in which they would make their presentations. First, on my far left is Larry McDonald, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Treasury for Technical Assistance Policy at the U.S. Treasury Department. Larry oversees programs in over 70 countries on five related areas: budget policy, tax policy, government debt, banking and financial regulation, and financial enforcement. From 1993 to 1996, he was economic advisor to the government of Albania, and in 2004, he was awarded the Treasury Secretary's Honor Award for contributions to economic reconstruction in Iraq. We're very pleased to have Larry. Thank you. Next to speak will be, on my immediate left, Andrew Cunningham, Managing Director and Head of Middle East and Balkans Programs at the Financial Services Volunteer Corps based in New York. FSVC is a not-for-profit public-private partnership that recruits and deploys financial, regulatory, and legal experts to in emerging markets and in some troubled states. His areas of expertise include capacity building and institutional development in emerging financial sectors. He speaks Arabic, French, Greek, and some Farsi. Welcome. And next, we are very pleased to have on my far right William Byrd, who recently joined the World Bank's Fragile and Conflict Affected Countries Group as an economic advisor. He has been at the World Bank for over 2 decades, providing both thought and operational leadership in a number of countries, including China, Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan. He recently led a team that produced the World Bank's first economic report on Afghanistan in 25 years and has authored groundbreaking work on public financial management in that country. Thank you very much for joining us, William. And our fourth speaker will be Lex Rifo, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His stellar career has straddled both the scholarly and the policy worlds. Positions he has held include with the United States Department of the Treasury, USAID, and the Institute of International Finance. His academic credentials include adjunct professor positions at George Washington University and Johns Hopkins. He's a former U.S. ambassador to the OECD in Paris and has also served as U.S. executive director to the International Monetary Fund, ICHA.
Not the ambassador, just on the staff of the ambassador.
Okay, on the staff of the ambassador, but he was U.S. executive director of the International Monetary Fund. I got that right.
Staff of the.
Okay, on the staff of the U.S. executive director. We're very pleased to have the four panelists. Before I invite Larry to kick us off, I would like to encourage us all to turn our cell phones off. I know a number of us are expecting urgent calls from the transition team, but I'm sure we'll take voicemail after 2 hours. And without much more ado, I'd invite Larry to speak.
Thank you, Raymond. First, I want to say that I'm very grateful for the opportunity to participate on today's panel. It's great to be back with friends and colleagues. I want to thank the Institute of Peace and Raymond Yuen in particular for giving attention to this topic, not only today, but in a number of other events and studies that the Institute of Peace has sponsored. I agree with you very much that our consideration of the subject is extremely timely. The new administration is really in the process right now of assessing or reassessing the best way forward in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and other conflict-affected states. And they're also assessing what's the most effective way to provide foreign assistance generally. Today's topic, public finance management, is close to Treasury's heart, and it is very much at the heart of Treasury's technical assistance program. Our mission, indeed, as I see up there, is to strengthen public finance management in financial sectors in developing and transition countries. We've been pursuing that mission since the creation of the program nearly 20 years ago, and as you mentioned, Raymond, we're now active in 50 to 70 countries. It varies by time throughout Africa, Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, and now just a handful of countries in Central and Eastern Europe in the former Soviet Union where the program was born, actually. Now, since 1996, in particular, Treasury has been active and carried out quite a few missions in conflict-affected countries, such as the ones on the screen, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Liberia, Haiti, and Iraq. Today, in my remarks, I want to go over three things, basically: the link between public financial management and aid effectiveness, as I see it, about the special challenges that arise in conflict-affected countries, and about the role that technical assistance can play in strengthening public financial management, and some observations about the most effective way to provide such technical assistance. And at the end, or along the way, I'll note some things that, in my view, merit further investigation, because I think there are some very important issues that merit further consideration. I'd like to start by quickly defining my terms, or at least my understanding of those terms. When I refer to public financial management, I'm talking about government institutions and systems for generating and collecting financial resources for the state, however that's done, whether it's through taxes and various kinds, customs duties, or government borrowing. It's about creating a plan for the use of those resources, in other words, a budget. It's about implementing that plan through expenditures, investments, procurements, and so on. And finally, a system of controls to monitor whether the plan was actually implemented or whether it was an interesting work of fiction. As for aid effectiveness, I mean, entire books have been written on this topic. I'll just note that for me, the essence of aid effectiveness comes down to a couple of things, two tests, if you like. First, I think, and this is not an original thought, I confess, aid needs to go beyond relief and assistance efforts. It needs to contribute to a rising standard of living, however you want to define that, but I would say better health, better education, more goods and services, more opportunities, and a reasonable degree of personal safety and security. I think the Help Commission got it right. Their study came out about a year ago when they emphasized the importance of moving beyond aid. That was indeed the centerpiece of their study. Second, aid, in my view, also needs to be temporary. And when I say temporary, I don't mean that it needs to be short-term, that it needs to be slapdash, sort of quick in and out. Often it needs to be medium-term or even long-term. But it does not need to be and should not be permanent. To be effective, aid needs to plan from the beginning for its end. And towards that end, I think that aid needs to strengthen the capacity of counterpart institutions and the individuals within those institutions so that they can avoid the trap of aid dependency and truly take ownership, this word that we all use and we all throw around, but truly take ownership of their own development. Now, among practitioners, I think there's a general recognition that sound public financial management is really important, so I don't think that point is at issue or debate today. But the importance of public financial management, in my experience anyway, is that it is seen in relatively narrow technical terms, in terms of revenue generation, reducing financial leakages, more orderly budget processes, and so on. Those things are extremely important in their own right. The first order importance of public financial management is extremely important, so I don't mean to minimize that in any way. But what's not so widely recognized, and this is one of my central points today, is the importance of sound public financial management for broader development objectives, for the effectiveness of overall foreign assistance, and indeed for some strategic objectives, stability, security, and even peace. The way I conceive of it, and there are lots of different ways that one can portray this, is as public financial management as a little wheel or a gear that connects to and helps turn some very important big wheels. Now, I don't have a pointer, but you see in the middle, the smallest one, the green wheel, is public financial management. It is both part of and connects to public services. I mean, this is the most obvious first order connection. Revenue generation, for example, leading to the provision of public investments and infrastructure. Public financial management also has an important connection to private business, the biggest wheel. An important connection to private sector-led growth, investment, and all the things that go into private sector-led growth. I was in Haiti just last week, where one of Treasury's efforts is to support the establishment of a tax regime and a tax administration system that is more transparent, more understandable, and implemented, and simpler, and implemented in a way that promotes investment and encourages business to operate in the formal sector. So, whether it's Haiti, Guatemala, Honduras, any number of places where we're working on tax matters, one of the first order goals is to increase revenues, but an equally important and vital second order objective is to do that in a way that is supportive of more robust private sector-led growth. Public financial management has an important connection with security, the wheel on the bottom. Now, protecting financial systems against criminal and terrorist activities has become a headline item in the post-9/11 world. But a less obvious connections between security and traditional sort of bread and butter financial management activities are equally important and equally compelling, in my view. One of the best examples I can think of is Iraq. There's been a major effort over the last year and a little more to strengthen the capacity of the Iraqi government to conduct public financial management activities better, and in particular, to execute the budget. Now, that effort has as much to do with stability objectives, lowering the tension level generally, getting electricity going, getting young guys off the streets and doing other things rather than becoming involved in activities that are contrary to the interests of stability and security. It has as much to do with those security objectives as it does with traditional financial management objectives. Now, that the connection between better financial management and better security, as well as the need to better organize and coordinate our own assistance efforts, became so compelling that a special unit was created called the Public Financial Management Action Group that integrates Treasury technical advisors and U.S. military counterparts. I saw that group in action when I was in Baghdad in November. Jeremy Pham, who is in our audience today, was one of the architects, frankly, of the creation of that group. For now, though, the point I want to emphasize is that for the little wheel of public financial management to mesh with those other wheels, I mean the teeth, for it to have those gears that mesh, the institutions that are responsible for public financial management have to have the capacity and the opportunity to perform their roles more effectively. Here's where an important issue arises that has to do with opportunity. Not infrequently, donors work around the counterpart state institutions delivering assistance either directly to the ultimate recipient or working through other channels such as NGOs or private contractors. One might call this the deliver versus nurture dilemma. There are a number of reasons why donors sometimes choose to deliver aid by other channels rather than nurturing and working through state institutions. I think there are understandable reasons that, in a number of cases. You know, often there's a lack of confidence in the counterpart's ability to manage assistance well. There's a concern that the counterpart will either fritter the assistance away or maybe even steal it. And there's a concern that strengthening the counterpart's capacity to do things better is going to take years, which actually it will. Against this backdrop of urgency and concerns, there's a sense of urgency to deliver assistance as quickly as you can. That's totally understandable, especially when you're talking about assistance that may mean the difference between life and death, such as the delivery of antiretroviral drugs. There's also a sense of urgency by the donors to show results and to meet progress benchmarks. This is an urgency that's driven in large part by our own performance and budget considerations, and frankly by competition for limited funding. And it should be said that there's a vested interest sometimes to continue to be the channel through which aid is delivered rather than working through the counterparts institutions. So in sum, there are a lot of motivations for going around the state, sometimes very understandable ones, but we need to recognize that there are significant trade-offs and costs in terms of the credibility of the state in the eyes of its citizenry, which is an important factor, especially in conflict-affected states, and in terms of sustaining the gains of assistance. Strengthening the capacity of aid recipients to be better financial managers in no way guarantees success, but I do contend that it improves the chances that our major investments in areas such as debt relief, healthcare, education, infrastructure development, and strengthening security forces will have a better chance of being sustained. Unfortunately, there are a lot of examples, too many examples, of debt relief recidivism and infrastructure not being maintained. And part of the reason for that is because we didn't invest along the way in strengthening the capacity of our counterparts to be better managers of those systems and those investments down the line. Now, I want to make clear, I'm not arguing for a massive increase in technical assistance certainly not, and not for public financial management. Our largest investments should be in areas such as education, healthcare, infrastructure, and agriculture. These are the main drivers of economic growth. So it's absolutely appropriate that the most of the money and most of the attention go to those things. They're important for that rising standard of living, which for me is the first test of aid effectiveness. But I do maintain that strengthening public financial management capacity is the $1 investment that improves the chances that multi-million dollar investments in these other areas will be sustained. Now, there's some encouraging signs that this relationship between public financial management and bigger objectives is being recognized. And one example that I'm very interested in is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. Last year, in 2008, the legislation reauthorizing PEPFAR included language authorizing the Treasury Department to provide assistance to improve the effectiveness of public finance management systems in PEPFAR countries so that they can be better positioned to begin receiving funding and to better manage programs to combat HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria down the line. Thus far, no funds have been provided to Treasury to work in PEPFAR countries. As the old saying goes, an authorization is not an appropriation, but I am hopeful that it will begin to happen this year. Let me turn, without further ado, to conflict-affected countries. It's entirely appropriate that we give this group of countries special attention, as they represent the biggest challenge for development and security, I think. Now, this group of countries is multifaceted and diverse. It includes great diversity in terms of geographic distribution, income level, natural resource endowment, and the immediacy and intensity of the conflict. I'm not sure how many countries we would say are out there that are conflict-affected countries, but it's a range of countries. In terms of the intensity of the conflict and its immediacy, in some cases, the bullets have just stopped flying, or they're still flying. And even when there isn't open, ongoing conflict, there's typically lingering animosities that are just beneath the surface and maybe concentrated in particular regions. In all these situations, doesn't matter, it's crucial for public financial authorities to be seen as managing the public purse with as much credibility as possible. Not infrequently, one of the original sources of the conflict is that the authorities were mismanaging or even robbing the public purse. The problem is, one of the big problems is that managing public finances well, which is difficult enough to do in peacetime, is doubly difficult in a conflict environment. A friend of mine who once served as the Minister of Finance and Economy in a conflict-affected African country described a challenge kind of like this. You know, one group has just fought its way to victory and is eager to cash in on its position. Another group has just been deposed and is pretty unhappy and not very inclined to be cooperative. The general public is worn out and looking to the state to begin providing basic public services. And the institutions of state, which were never that strong to begin with, may be physically damaged from the conflict. And the few capable, experienced public servants that were there may have left the country, been killed, or they're focused on addressing immediate family emergencies. So, in short, the demands, expectations, and the suspicions are all at their highest in these conflict-affected states at the very time that institutional capacity is at its lowest. Now, add to this landscape a large, well-meaning, but not very well-coordinated donor community, more or less doing its own thing, and possibly even a foreign military or peacekeeping presence, and you have quite a picture. In these kinds of circumstances, stormy circumstances, there needs to be an anchor, some point of reference or points of reference where one can begin to chart a course, around which one can begin to chart a course of action. Now, Treasury's candidate for this role is the national budget. And here I'm aligning myself with a number of people who have written on this topic, such as Ashraf Ghani, Claire Lockhart, James Boyce, Jeremy, and others. The national budget is the most appropriate vehicle, I believe, for domestic policy formulation and a crucial tool for coordination of foreign assistance. And so it's for these reasons that Treasury has given priority attention to supporting the budget process and to building capacity for effective budget execution in virtually all of the conflict-affected countries that we've been involved in. An outstanding example of this is Afghanistan, where the advisor, the finance minister, the minister's staff, kind of literally huddled around a laptop computer and produced the first framework budget and ultimately the first budget following the fall of the Taliban. I think priority attention should be given to a number of other public finance functions that are closely associated with the effective implementation of the budget. Restoring the financial plumbing, if you will, of the state. Setting up payment systems, procurement, expenditure controls, and so on. Why is this so important? The success or failure of this financial plumbing, in my view, goes a long way towards determining whether a conflict-affected state is going to put itself on a path of improvement or is going to fall back into conflict. Paul Collier has written that about half of all conflict wars are post-conflict relapses. I think that's true. I think that many states fall back into conflict for a lot of reasons, but in many cases it's because of failures in the public financial management system. A failure to pay the troops on time, failure to account for the use of foreign assistance, or a failure to generate domestic revenues and to ensure that they're at least beginning to be used to provide basic public services. What's the role for technical assistance in all this? The first observation that I would make is that there is a very wide-ranging set of conceptions about what constitutes technical assistance, ranging from simply providing the money to assessment and diagnosis visits, to short-term training classes, to long-term mentoring, and in some cases to actually doing the work for the country. There's a lot going on out there that falls under the umbrella, the big umbrella of technical assistance. I think there are two issues here that merit examination. First, I think it would be helpful to have good data on how much technical assistance is offered generally and how much is offered in specialized areas such as public financial management. It's actually very hard to get that data. A lot of it, it's certainly difficult to get data on public financial management technical assistance. It's frequently wrapped into a larger group such as economic governance. This is just for the United States. And when you, if you try to, I mean, the difficulty of getting good data on that internationally is very big. I think that it would be helpful to have a better understanding of the different categories, different kinds of technical assistance that are provided: short-term, medium-term, long-term, resident-based, delivery by private institutional contracts, by public providers, and so on. My strong sense, but it's only my sense, from discussions with various donors, both bilateral and multilateral, and with many aid recipients, is that most technical assistance, I couldn't put a number to it, but most technical assistance is short-term and often very short-term. I mean, the limiting factors to this are not a secret, I think. Cost and the willingness of advisors to reside and work long-term overseas, and sometimes in very difficult, even very, very dangerous environments. A second issue that I think merits attention or investigation is analysis of the effectiveness of these various ways of delivering technical assistance, and in particular in conflict and non-conflict settings. Now, without in any way claiming to have the inside track on the answers to these issues, let me just offer a few observations from Treasury's experience over the last 20 years. The first observation that I would offer is that the most effective technical assistance focuses on building capacity, human capacity and systems capacity, and that from Treasury's experience anyway, the most effective way to do that is through sustained engagement, working side by side with the counterpart in their institutions on real day-to-day problems. The emphasis should be on knowledge transfer. This is not to say, really, by any means, that diagnostics and short-term training are not valuable. They are. It's very important to understand what the problem is. But short-term, one-off training can be more of a distraction than a help, especially in conflict environments when it's all hands on deck, you're ducking, and there are so few counterparts with whom you can work. As far as diagnostic, it's essential to understand the problem, but it's what happens after the diagnosis that really counts. When I was a resident advisor overseas in Albania, as Raymond mentioned, I mean, honestly, my counterparts had quite a collection of diagnostic studies telling them all of the ways that they were underperforming. My second observation, and with a nod to the Marines, is a few good advisors. The foundation of effective technical assistance is to field advisors with real expertise and lots of experience in different settings, in addition to any academic or general knowledge that they have, which is also valuable. This may seem like an obvious point, but you'd be surprised. Sometimes there are trade-offs between quality and numbers, and sometimes people go for bigger numbers of advisors. From our experience, fielding a smaller number of highly experienced practitioners is better than fielding a large number of generalists or people who are relatively short on field experience. And this is especially true, again, in conflict-affected countries where your mobility and your access to counterparts may be limited, and there are relatively few counterparts with whom you can work anyway. So having a big number of people is not necessarily the optimal way to go. A third observation is best international practice is great, but good achievable practice is real good. Time and money are often simply wasted when donors and aid recipients invest in, for example, public finance management systems based on the latest technological advances or fad, only to find that the system is ill-suited to local needs and capacity, and the system, what happens? The system ends up being underutilized or sometimes completely ignored. Advocates of best international practice, and I confess, I'm a recovering best international practitioner, or BIPPER. The BIPPERs often miss the opportunities to take the little practical steps that build upon existing systems. So let's not be BIPPERs. Fourth, comparative advantage really matters. You know, building public finance management capacity is a relatively specialized discipline. So is rural development, or other things. You know, Treasury's experience has been that we have served others well when we stick to the things that we know best. We care a lot about private sector development. It's the biggest wheel on my chart, but we don't advise private companies. There are others who are better placed to do that. The Financial Services Volunteer Corps is a good example of that. And in fact, we've got a great example of collaboration and playing to comparative advantages is what we're doing in Algeria. A Treasury advisor working with the central bank on bank supervision has been collaborating with a counterpart from the Financial Services Volunteer Corps who's working with the private banks and the Bankers Association to team up and really use the best of what we both can offer. I would also say that you know, our affiliation with the Treasury Department has been enormously helpful to our effectiveness. Our counterparts generally welcome the fact that our advisors come from a sister institution and have kind of been there and done that in their own careers. Fifth and finally, the final observation or principle, it has to do with planning. Plan well, but don't overplan, and be ready to call a lot of audibles. Now, this is one area where military and civilian institutional cultures, or at least economic civilian institutional cultures, are kind of different, I think. For very good reasons, our military colleagues put a lot of emphasis on thorough and careful planning. For economists, the emphasis tends to be on sort of less detailed planning and more on things like getting the incentives right, establishing sensible ordering principles. I mean, I don't claim to know what the right amount of planning is, but I do know that in conflict-affected environments in which we have operated, and not just Iraq, you couldn't really rely, much less totally rely, on a preconceived game plan. It's good to have one. It's good to have something in mind and have it with you as a point of reference, but you've got to be ready to adjust to things that are unknowable and unforeseeable. And this is why, going back to my second observation about a few good advisors, you have to have really experienced people in the field who have a lot of leeway, and give them a lot of leeway to make the calls as they see it out in the field. That's a hard thing for headquarters or Washington agencies to do sometimes, but it's very important. In closing, I'd like to conclude with just two quotes that I think nicely illustrate some of the connections that we're exploring today among capacity building, finance, security, stability, and prosperity. First one reads like this. Over the long term, we cannot kill or capture our way to victory. Where possible, our strategy is to employ indirect approaches, primarily through building the capacity of partner governments. Building their capacity is arguably as important as, if not more, than the fighting that we do ourselves. Those words were written by Secretary of Defense Gates and appeared in a recent article in Foreign Affairs. Well, the second quote is shorter, and it goes like this. There can be no government without an army, no army without money, no money without prosperity, and no prosperity without justice and good administration. Now, those words could have come from a lot of places. They could have come from the website of OMB. They could have come from the website of one of the forward-thinking combatant commands. In fact, they were written over 1,000 years ago by a Muslim philosopher named Ibn Qutaybah. In Islamic thought, this passage, I understand, is known as, and I think quite appropriately, as the circle of justice. I thank you for your attention. I look forward to the other presentations and look forward very much to our discussion afterwards.
Thank you very much, Larry. Andrew?
Raymond, thank you very much for this opportunity to share some thoughts with you on behalf of the Financial Services Volunteer Corps. I'm going to start with a health warning, quite literally. I had flu last week, and I hope I'm not infectious for the sake of our panelists, but I do still have a little bit of a cough. So if I start, my throat gives out, then I shall exit stage left, and you can talk among yourselves for a minute or so, and then I'll come back in. But that's an incentive on me to keep my my remarks short. The presentation I'm going to give is based on my experience and the experience of my firm, the Financial Services Volunteer Corps, in building financial systems throughout the world in emerging markets. And I'm using that experience to back into some generalizations, as opposed to taking a theoretical approach and then trying to test that against experience. I'm going to, towards the end of the presentation, make some references to Iraq, to Albania, and you'll probably also find me making some references to Egypt, which, although it's not a conflict, a recent conflict country, is a country that I know reasonably well, having run FSVC's office there recently. I've got 13 slides for you, and there's an appendix at the back that I'll refer to but won't speak to. And as a sort of preview of where I'm going to end up, I will question whether a pre-existing conflict in itself changes the shape of aid and policy which we deliver, as opposed to the just the nature of the pre-existing regime. So is it the conflict or the nature of the regime which is really shaping the type of aid that we deliver? Now if we move on to the first slide. So I've got some remarks initially on how we approach building a public finance institutions, and then some examples. So I'll just move straight on. So I think we first of all have to think about where are we trying to get to when we try to build public finance institutions and management. And there's obviously many different ways that we can define that objective. This is what I've come up with, and I'm using that. I hope you can read that. And I'm using the adjectives effective in the sense that whatever it is that the government and the financial system is trying to do, it is able to do that. And we have to recognize that the policies and priorities of that government may not be our own. So a government may decide that it is a budgetary priority to finance kerosene. It may decide that it's a priority to build roads. And as long as that is transparent and it is representative, and by representative I mean that it's in line with the nature of the country itself and the wishes of its population, then we have to accept that that's a reasonable objective to pursue. I move on from there to some broad themes. I think we have to recognise, as Larry has already said, that there are no quick fixes. Reforming public finance and financial institutions, wherever they may be, takes a very long time. And I think there's a danger that perhaps some of us, and you can tell from my accent I'm British, so I perhaps have a European perspective, there's a danger of looking at the states of Eastern Europe, which moved pretty rapidly, you know, 10 to 15 years, from a communist system to a fairly capitalist, market-orientated system. But if you look at how they were able to do that, they were not huge economies. They were certainly not coming out of devastating conflict like Afghanistan or Iraq. And they also had a very clear model in terms of convergence and access into the European Union. In terms of laws and regulations, there was a clear road for them to take in adopting the acquis, the core body of laws and regulations within the European Union, and that's what they had to adopt themselves if they were going to get into the European Union themselves. So there was a clear model where these countries in Eastern Europe could aim for, in a way that, for example, I don't think there is with Afghanistan. If you read back into the history of Afghanistan, it's very hard to see a time where you say, okay, if we can get back to that sort of state, then we're not doing too badly. I can't identify any time when a government in Kabul or indeed any other state within the territory now called Afghanistan has had a writ which is really, over a sustained period of time, extended to that geographical territory. So it's hard to see what the model where you're trying to get to in a country like Afghanistan is. So the point I'm making there is simply that Eastern Europe was probably as good as it's going to get in many of these countries, and we have to accept that reform is going to take a very long time. Results will take a long time to emerge, but we as implementers must have our feet kept to the fire in terms of regularly reporting results. And I operate under that system as someone who receives funding from the State Department, receives funding from USAID. We produce quarterly reports, and it's quite right that we should do so, accepting the fact that results will emerge over a very long period of time. And the third broad theme I have is the ironic point that institutional development depends on individuals. And we all know this from our own experience in our own organisations. If you have a good team of people, you can achieve the stars. If you don't have a good team of people, then no committee structure, no institutional process that you put around those people will make up for the deficiencies of your team. And so when you go into institutions and try to build them up, you have to identify the key individuals. But this provides you with a problem, because in many emerging markets, as we'll see, there are very few key, talented, powerful individuals, and they tend to move around. So you have this challenge of you maybe building someone up in the central bank, and suddenly that person is in the Ministry of Finance. And to some extent what we're doing there is building up a cadre of individuals who over time can take leadership of a country and have what we would perceive to be the correct attitudes and correct policies. As we move into speaking to institutions and individuals, I just wanted to say it's very important to think about what's the nature of the conversation we're having. Ideally, you're having a conversation which is, what is it that, so you go into the central bank or you go into the Ministry of Finance, you say, what is it you're trying to do? And they say, well, we are trying to create a system which is effective, transparent, representative, and so on. And you say, okay, how can we help? The danger is that you have a conversation which is, you know, what is it you're trying to do? And someone says, well, we're trying to strengthen the ability of the government to direct resources and set prices based on five-year plans. Now, there's actually very few people who are going to say that now. If you have that discussion with President Ahmadinejad, that's probably the response you'll get. If you go into North Korea, that's probably the response you'll get. Everybody believes in reform, but reform means different things to different people. So for some people, reform means improving the payment system. and improving the speed of check clearing. And that's important in itself. The plumbing is very important. But it does not. But reform does not mean addressing ownership questions within the economy. And if you're going to reform the financial system, you have to address ownership questions. So the nature of the conversation that you're having with your counterpart will very much affect the type of assistance that you can provide. Now, books can be written and have been written on the question of how you prioritise and sequence your assistance. I've put in this slide just because it's something that we come across a lot, which is that the type of advice we're providing is about what you do first and what you can leave for 6 months down the road. Generally, you're dealing with people who are smart. I mean, you wouldn't be dealing with them if they weren't. You'd have found someone else to deal with. They're often Western trained. They've read the textbooks. They may have degrees in the United States. They get it. But what they don't know is what they should do next Monday morning when they get into the office. You know, when the Central Bank of Egypt started its reform program at the end of 2003, beginning of 2004, they hired a lot of city bankers. And they got it. Very market orientated, but they were very good commercial bankers, Egyptians who come back, very good commercial bankers, but they didn't understand central banking, so they needed technical assistance on what does a central bank do as opposed to a commercial bank. I would like to pick up the point that Larry made about international best practices. I very much agree with the danger of international best practices. Our process in FSVC for project approval is that after the field has had a discussion with the counterpart, they surface a project description ultimately to me for approval, and I have banned the words international best practices from project descriptions, because I find that often when people use the words international best practices, it's a cover for the fact that they don't really know what they need. We want to align our processes with international best practices. What exactly is the problem that you're facing and which you're trying to solve? And often one doesn't actually, international best practices can lead you in the wrong direction. A lot of the volunteers that we deploy are from the United States, but a lot of them aren't. So we provided expertise from the Warsaw Stock Exchange into the Cairo Stock Exchange, and also from the Bombay Stock Exchange into the Cairo Stock Exchange, which we thought was far more relevant than providing experts from the New York Stock Exchange, which is so far ahead of where Cairo is and where it can realistically be. I have, as part of this, I'm going to try to see if I can go very quickly ahead, and then I'm going to come back. Gone too far. So you can produce a typology of the issues that you need to address. And this is, I just reproduced this from something I wrote last year on how you sequence financial sector reform. And you can break it down into central banking, commercial banking, capital markets, broader financial infrastructures, that's insurance and leasing and so on, and then financial enabling environments, that is judges, judicial systems, collateral registries, credit bureaus, accounting professions, and so on. So it's quite easy to come up, I think, with that sort of typology of issues which you need to hit. And then within that, you can start prioritizing of what and sequencing in an ideal world. And if anyone's interested in that, I can give you that typology afterwards. I do think that you have to start, if you're reforming your financial system, with the central bank. If you have a strong central bank, then the central bank will put a fire under the commercial banking system. And it will also have the ability to resolve issues of payment systems. And if you do not have a strong central bank, then you will achieve nothing in your commercial banking system. Now, we could have an idealized sequencing and prioritization, but then we're going to hit some of our local constraints. So you have the number of local officials who are A, highly competent, and B, have the power to implement are very few. They're extremely busy people. The number of them who speak English is going to be few in some countries. And so what that leads you to is the capacity of local counterparts to absorb technical assistance is very limited. We're trying to push an awful lot of product through the pipe. And that inevitably means that there's going to be delays, and it's going to take us a lot of time to get our results. And then there may be logistical challenges arising from security problems in a country like Iraq or Afghanistan, but from the quality of the infrastructure. It may be dangerous or just very difficult to get out of the capital area. But I think we have to recognize that often the biggest constraint we have is the absorptive capacity of our local counterparts. Now that's on the resource side. If we look at constraints on the policy side, local factors can lead to what to us seems to be illogical prioritization. We're dealing with a country at the moment which is certainly emerging and has some issues of civil war, which wants to set up a stock market. Now, I know that what this country really needs is a better banking system, but they're determined to set up a stock market, and we're going to help them, because if they're going to do this, we want them to do it in the right way. And also, very importantly, they've told us that they recognize that building a stock market brings with it a number of other things which are good in themselves. If you're going to have a stock market, you have to have better corporate governance, you have to have a strong accounting profession, you have to have better corporate disclosure, and those are all good things which will lead to a stronger financial system. Another factor, and I just put this in the light of current financial market turmoil, is whether there will be a willingness to continue to espouse market-orientated policies in view of the fact that in the United States and in Europe we're nationalizing all our banks. And we've just done a seminar in Libya where we're advocating market-based systems and encouraging them to continue privatizing their banks. Incredibly, they didn't push back at us and say, well, how can you possibly say that, seeing as you just nationalized all your banks? But I do think that over the long term, that could be a constraint. So if I just move quickly to Iraq. And we started working with the Central Bank of Iraq in the third quarter of last year, working directly with the central bank. And clearly the biggest constraint that we have is getting people into Baghdad. It's a constraint on many levels. We can recruit volunteers. The experts we send in are volunteers. It's a tall order to ask a volunteer to go into Baghdad, or it certainly was until the security situation started to improve. Nonetheless, we can find people who will do that. But there's a question of misaligned selection. The people who are willing to go to Baghdad may not be the best people for the job. It also costs a lot of money, so we would have to have a discussion with our funders, in this case the State Department. Do you want us spending that money on security, or do you want us spending it on other forms of technical assistance? We have sent people to Baghdad, but we've also done projects outside, places like Geneva and Istanbul. Now think of this, we kicked off our program with a meeting with the governor and the deputy governor of the central bank for 2 days in Geneva. We had their undivided attention for 2 days. We would not have had that if we were in Baghdad. Now I know that it's very good to provide the technical assistance in place, but we could not have done that particular piece of work in Baghdad. It was much better to do it outside. The second point here is that the institutionalization of public finance structures tends to be skewed in Iraq. The Ministry of Finance is hugely powerful in relation to the central bank, even though the central bank is legally independent. The Supreme Bureau of Audit is more powerful than you would think. And that is a result of the Saddam era, not as a result of conflict. It's because if the government in the Saddam era wanted to go after someone, they would charge them with corruption, and the way in which they pursued that was through the Supreme Board of Audit. You don't get on the wrong side of the Supreme Board of Audit. And so you have skewed importances. Very few officials speak English. That's a big problem that we have. So we have to use interpreters. And one can try to find Arabic speakers, but it's the same sort of problems you have of misalignment of volunteers. You can get people to go there, you can find Arabic speakers, but they may not be the right people. I'm going to move on quickly as Raymond passes me another note. An important thing to recognize is that time is more important than money. Just about everybody we deal with has got money. And they're poor countries. Iraq is not actually a poor country. But they have money to pay for the type of assistance that we provide. What they don't have is time. And so as you deliver your assistance, what you want people to feel is that was a really useful half day we spent with those people. That was a really well spent day. And if you can get them to feel that, then you will get traction. You have to make a huge effort to understand the challenges being faced by your counterparts. We were told when we started, not by our funders but by others, that you will hear things that seem really illogical to you. You will hear people who espouse market systems, who appear to be saying all the right things, and then something will come out of left field. And you have to, and it may seem obvious to you that you should have a central bank which can effectively supervise the banks, which can go in and inspect the banks and produce good reports. But it's not necessarily obvious to everybody, and a lot of people are working under very different pressures. The people in Baghdad go to work, and they don't know, their families don't know if they're going to come back that night. The threats, the pressures, the influences on people in Baghdad are things that you and I just can't imagine. And that skews their reaction to the policy environment. And you have to listen very carefully to what people are saying and why are they saying it, what's behind that, as you try to formulate a policy response. I'm going to move on quickly through Albania. simply to say, when we started working there in the late 90s, you have to work with who's there. That was the comment of one of our country directors at the time. There are very few institutions you can work with. Many of the ministries were corrupt. Just about the only institution you could work with was the central bank, so that's who we worked with. The lack of infrastructure presented distractions from pure program activity. One of my program officers said that you always had to have a backup venue because the electricity was going to go off. You had to think, well, where are we going to decamp to provide this technical assistance when the electricity goes off? So we focused on the central bank. And we weren't afraid to shift our programmatic focus if we couldn't make headway. So if we found that we were working with an institution and certain key individuals moved out, then we might have to just stop working with that institution. And you have to keep your funders appraised, and they usually understand that. And final thoughts, three very different thoughts. If I was coming into the administration now, I would double or hugely increase the resources that are given to English language training. I'm afraid I don't know whether you have an equivalent of the British Council, which teaches English overseas. But you certainly need to be, if you can get people to speak English, you can push a lot more product through the pipe, which you've identified as one of the problems. You have to upgrade technology used by your counterparts as fast as you upgrade their skills. And what's in the back of my mind there is Lebanon after the Civil War. I was analysing banks for a rating agency in 96, 97. And a lot of people had come back from the Gulf. They were really good bankers. They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they couldn't do it because they hadn't got the technology, because the phones didn't work. You couldn't do electronic banking because the phones didn't work. So you had people, the banks were reconciling their accounts at the end of the day because the branches would send in floppy disks on the back of a motorbike to the head office, which then that's how you reconciled your accounts because the technology just wasn't working. And then the final point I'll make is to distinguish between logistical challenges and policy challenges, and recognize that, in my view, policy challenges are likely to be shaped more by the type of government which prevailed in the past than by the type of conflict itself. And I think certainly what we're seeing in Iraq And the problems we're facing there is the legacy of a brutal totalitarian government that's been in charge for decades. And I think if Saddam had done what Gaddafi had done, say in 2003, and said, okay, we are going to come to a grand bargain and make peace with the West, and there had been no invasion and no occupation, I think the type of technical assistance we'd be providing in Iraq would be pretty much exactly what we're providing now after the conflict. The difference would be that logistically it would be much easier to do.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Bill?
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. I think I'm not going to go over what I was originally going to talk about, the importance of public finance management, because other speakers have covered that very well. But basically, managing funds is a key function of any functioning state, and it's critically important. And I think hitherto in many post-conflict or fragile environments neglected. I'm actually going to talk mainly about Afghanistan because that's where I have the hands-on experience. I think a lot of the lessons are applicable, and particularly some of the ingredients of success may be more widely applicable. But I will do that, and then I'll try to draw some lessons for a bilateral donor, perhaps like the U.S., at the end. And first, I'll probably talk shorter than Raymond would like, except maybe this will make up for keep the time within bounds. But I do want to advertise a little bit. I mean, the World Bank has produced enormous volume of analytical diagnostic work, rating work, like the PIFA assessment we did recently. We have a five-volume report on public finance management from a couple of years ago with a glossy summary. And most recently in January, together with a co-author, I put out a policy research working paper called Public Finance, Security, and Development. And so I think I won't belabor these points, but I think these linkages are becoming increasingly important and well-known and are touched on by the other speakers. So let me focus on Afghanistan and really some of the lessons and the ingredients of success. This has been a central area of the World Bank's engagement. 10 weeks after we set foot in Afghanistan, we were at our board of directors with a PFM project. I mean, so this was like the first priority, and I could explain later why the World Bank's incentives, I'll explain now why the World Bank's incentives are that we have to work with a sovereign government, which means if some of these PFM things are not functional, it becomes extremely difficult for us to provide aid. So the World Bank incentives are very much aligned with the idea of building up government, PFM, and I'll come back to that later. So, I mean, some of the lessons are, I'll pick up on Larry's earlier point, because I think most of this was not planned in advance in any detail. It was, you know, going with a vision and the idea that the government manages funds, and then all the implications of that come out over time, constraints are run into and dealt with. But certainly, you know, if my presentation gives the impression that in 2002 all the details had been thought out, that's absolutely not true. We were winging it. We were working very fast, but again, with the objective that the government could manage money as sort of a central objective. And I think we applied a number of different instruments, including analytical work, which I mentioned. You need to understand the context, what context there is. There, it's a very aid-dependent country with some government institutions, but certainly a vacuum built up over 30 years. So the knowledge and context are extremely important. I think exploiting the synergies across different instruments is very important, and I think you should not look at TA in isolation. It's certainly one of the important instruments, along with analytical work. And by the way, Larry, we would not even count diagnostic work as TA. We would consider that part of either the World Bank's non-lending work or our analytical work or something like that. So we would not even want to count that as part of TA, which fully agree should be part of focused on capacity building. We did a number of TA projects, and the fact that first $10 million project was a TA project to help get payments, audit, and procurement moving. So there were a lot of TA projects. There was also a series of three $80 million budget support operations, putting money into the budget. That dynamic in itself then sets up a whole other things about how are the government budget functions working? Are they working enough that we can credibly say that this money will not be misused or wasted? This then sets up dynamic incentives to make things work, both on the government side and also certainly on our side. And even bigger than that, what's really large is a multi-donor trust fund, which I think it's now about 28 donors, including the U.S. as well as others, are contributing, and it's now dispersed well over $2 billion to the Afghanistan budget. So again, these dynamics of pushing money through the budget, that then requiring a lot of things to be in place, sets up, a very powerful incentive. I'm not going to talk on the revenue side much. It's an area of, relatively less success. And I'm not going to talk on the central bank and macro policy, not because it's not important. In fact, they got the macro policy right, and it's an extremely important achievement. And the central bank has been the recipient and has become more effective. And I think the policy has been broadly online. And that's a huge benefit, which I'm not going to talk in detail, but there was a whole... there was TA, and there's an IMF program, et cetera, which supported that area. And again, the point that other speakers mentioned, go into it with a medium-term approach. Again, the bank, I think, our incentives there are aligned rightly. I mean, in many situations, our incentives may not be aligned rightly, but we're a long-term development institution. It's not that we would think about exiting from Afghanistan after 5, 10, or 20 years. So we want... Again, be there for the long haul. It's now 8 years later, and we could talk about the specifics in PFM, but there are obviously other aspects of the situation which are certainly not going as well as expected, to say the least. So we need the long picture. Close cooperation with the government. I mean, this just doesn't work without some government leadership and champions. It both applies to the TA side, where I would argue without having some government leadership and oversight of the TA, a lot of it's going to be wasted. It also applies on the policy side. It applies on the institution building side. And in Afghanistan, there was the early efforts to build up both the Ministry of Finance and Central Bank were relatively successful. You can talk to people three or four levels down from the minister in the Ministry of Finance and get intelligent discussion. This is not true of all Afghan ministries. So again, that is really critical, the government leadership and proactivity. Now, I should add the government incentives were also somewhat aligned, at least in terms of, it was clear that without good progress on PFM, this $3 billion of donor trust fund, let alone the $180 million of World Bank budget support, would not have materialized. So some of their short-term incentives also became aligned toward this. And then I think critical also is collaboration with international partners, DFID, IMF, as Treasury in some areas, and ADB has collaborated on different aspects. As I mentioned, the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund has some 28 donors. This is very important, it's never an easy battle, and the battle is really not necessarily that the World Bank should be in some kind of driver's seat. Really, the battle is to keep the government in the driver's seat when you have a management team on the government that is capable and sort of willing to push forward the agenda. Now, some of the problems I already mentioned on the revenue side. I think there's been also a lot of effort, a lot of TA put in, and a lot of sort of conditionality, because the risk of putting all this large amounts of money through the budget is that the revenue effort goes down, and this is something I think earlier leadership in the Ministry of Finance was very strongly aware of and went out of their way to avoid that, and the revenue to GDP ratio doubled in the early years, more than doubled actually. from a very low base. I think that kind of willingness to go against the incentives is maybe less. And then at the same time, the donors are now, we're now working with donors on the trust fund, a very challenging effort to reduce over time the recurrent budget support, so that sends the right signal in terms of, you know, but not pulling it out suddenly, because that would be a disaster, but some kind of phased process where domestic revenue clearly further increases. A lot of the, you know, this is a bit more on the TA side, but a lot of the ingredients of success were buying in capacity. And I think they're good lessons at a micro level from how you buy in the capacity. You certainly don't have tons of individual consultants from 28 or 15 or 10 donors, each running around and doing their things. And you get very dysfunctional syndromes where the TA actually is part of the problem. And I think it was mentioned, a few good advisors. That's really the right advice. And it's not quite that. I mean, the better functioning ministries in Afghanistan, which certainly includes finance and central bank, they manage their TA, and they may have less or they may have more than other ministries. I mean, they may have more because they actually can use it better. But there are many other, the dysfunctional ministries, it's not that they have very little TA, it's that they have tons of TA without leadership from the government ministry that's dysfunctional and becomes part of the problem, because in that kind of situation, you put in more TA, it's not going to, it could make things worse due to lack of coordination of TA, et cetera. So, but my point on this, I think a central point is, where do you go from now? You've bought in capacity, I think, you know, on payments, accounting, procurement. There is efforts to make sure that this is building the capacity, but it's also an uphill battle, because in Afghanistan, at least, you were starting with so little effective capacity within the government bureaucracy that essentially you were hiring firms, which, by the way, is far better than hiring individuals, to actually take almost an operational role, let's say, in managing the payment system, doing the audit, you know, supervising procurement. I mean, I think a key point would be, this should be contracted through the government. This should be done by the government, not by individual bilateral donors. I mean, a consultant firm that does a terrible job when they're working for a bilateral may actually do an excellent job when they're competing with other consulting firms to work for the government. And there are actually cases which I think Ashraf Ghani would be very happy, the former finance minister, to discuss. I don't think I should mention them specifically. So there are a lot of clear lessons on there and ingredients of success in Afghanistan, because it is success. And you know, we found from an assessment that their public finance systems are functioning reasonably well, surprisingly well, for that part of aid that goes through the budget, and that will come to later. So you know, there are a lot of but how do you move from that, where you essentially have international firms and capacity bought in and effectively, let's say, reasonably effectively providing some capacity, to a system whereby over time the civil service and the government does that on its own? And it's a challenging transition. There are lots of issues on the pay scales. There certainly has been improvement, let's say, in these departments in the Ministry of Finance, Treasury, budget, et cetera. And there are a lot more Afghans who are actually doing a lot more of the work. Many of them are not, most of them are, almost all of them are, all of them are not on the none of them are on the $50 a month standard Afghan civil service pay scale. And so how do you challenge this and then sort of marry it over time with something called public administration reform, which, you know, makes PFM look easy by comparison. And so I think, you know, how do you build on the success and move forward is critical. There are a lot of other issues moving beyond the Ministry of Finance to the line ministries. In a situation of lack of capacity, it often makes sense initially to be centralized. You focus on building capacity of the central units. Over time, this has to move beyond that. Subnational budget process is very interesting, and it's getting challenging and political, and there are a lot of needs there. On corruption, I'll just mention that as a point, because it's often used as an excuse not to provide money through the budget. I think we actually have a credible system in place to reduce vulnerabilities to corruption in relation to the money that goes through the Afghan budget. That does not exist for bilaterally executed aid, for all of the government revenues, particularly those diverted from budget channels, from the drug economy, from the hiring of private security firms by many actors, international and domestic, and so on. And I think you could make a case that it's those, it's abuse of power and abuse of money that's not in the Afghan national budget where are the primary sources of corruption. There is a credible story and further improvements needed, but it's on that relatively small part of the money that goes through the budget. Maybe, I think I've been jumping around a little bit, but let me now focus on what some of the lessons are for the bilateral donors, because, you know, I'd be the last person to say the World Bank is a good organization under all circumstances. I mean, we have to work with sovereign governments. That's one of the key, you know, the bulk of the World Bank's money that we intermediate, whether it's money raised through our bond sales or the IDA assistance, which is provided by donors, has to be through sovereign governments. And I fully believe in that. In some situations, that can be a disadvantage. I would argue that in Afghanistan, it was an advantage, because the World Bank's own incentives were very much aligned with building the government capacity to manage public finances. Now, when we come to a bilateral donor, there's some, I guess. The Netherlands, for example, contributed the first 35 million euros to the trust fund, along with the UK, 10 million pounds. I think the Afghanistan Trust Fund would not have taken off the way it did without some crucial, well-intentioned donors saying, we don't have the systems in place, but we know this is the direction you do. Let's put some money in the budget. And a couple of years later, the World Bank also threw in 80 million, which actually is not through the trust fund. It's actually much more vulnerable and exposed because it relies purely on the Afghan budget processes. I didn't get into the trust fund in much. It goes through the Afghan budget. It has some extra monitoring and accountability, which helps. So donors who may not want to just provide a budget support operation, the government can provide money to the trust fund, which is also through the budget. It has a lot of the same implications, but it has a few extra safeguards. But when, you know, you get to very bilaterally oriented donors, some of them, they have an incentive not to put the money through the budget. Some of it is on the reasons that Larry was saying about speed, lack of capacity for government to implement. And I would argue that some of the most successful programs in Afghanistan have gone through the government, and they've not been terribly slow. We were all complaining about the community development program in the first 2 years, but, I mean, it may take 2 years to develop a suitable program which delivers development results nationwide, and now it's becoming so successful that it's outrun the money. So I would challenge a little bit this idea of speed working through the government. I think I've already challenged, and I think it's an absolutely ridiculous notion that you avoid the risk of corruption by not going through the government. I think that's almost an irresponsible argument which suggests that it's self-serving. And then on the capacity issues, again, if you're looking short-term to long-term, I think you have extremely difficult issues in the long-term on capacity building. In the short run, you can actually... It's much better for the government with a credible small leadership team in some of these ministries to buy in the capacity if they need it. And then it raises issues of the medium term. But in the short run, you do have a choice of, do you build parallel structures, whether it's on NGOs or UN system or private companies, or do you let the government buy in the capacity? And maybe the same companies, NGOs, but competitively procured by the government, you actually see a difference in their incentives. And so I think there really needs to be some key points. I mean, for example, the U.S. is it ranges between the second and the fourth largest donor to the Afghanistan Trust Fund. The U.K. is the largest. Netherlands, Canada have been very other large donors. But it's tiny. I doubt it's even 1% of total U.S. aid. Larry, I mean, it depends what you define as U.S. aid, but if you include some of the military-related aid, you start really seeing this is tiny. So how do you change, how do bilateral donors go against the stream of their incentives is a difficult challenge. I think there are also some more specific messages on TA. Larry, I think, made some very good points, and I won't repeat those. This is a really positive example of a multi-donor trust fund and how that can be leveraged together with other initiatives to improve capacity. So, again, each country is different. Afghanistan, I think, is almost an exception in how well MDD, the trust fund, has worked, and I could go into the reasons for that. But certainly, this seems like a way to, again, align incentives, push money. The final point I'll make is you really need some learning by doing. If you didn't have that initial push to get money into the Afghan budget and to make it work, it's just a circular argument to say the government doesn't have capacity, therefore we don't provide money to the government, to and through the government. You have to sort of break that chain. And there's, on the fiduciary risks, it's really the level is important, but the direction is more important. If they're moving in a proper direction to reduce fiduciary risks, that should give confidence to donors. And in the case of Afghanistan, it did, because as I said, it's been successful in mobilizing a lot of money. I apologize for taking longer, but thank you.
Thank you very much, Will. Lex.
Raymond, thank you very much for inviting me to participate on this panel. Why am I here? I don't really think it's because of my stellar career. I don't think of it as stellar, but it has been wide-ranging. And it's been permeated by work related to public financial management without my realizing it. Going back to undergraduate studies in economic development in the 1960s, I did my thesis, BA thesis, on government promotion of small enterprise in India. I spent a year with the U.S. Navy in Vietnam and observed firsthand the limits of foreign intervention. I did a master's thesis on rice intensification in Indonesia. This was very shortly after one of the most spectacular cases of conflict, a very bloody transition from the Sukarno presidency to the Suharto presidency. I went to USAID in the early 70s. As a program economist, and concluded after a couple of years there that the biggest bang for the buck for the U.S. Foreign assistance buck was the technical assistance. We were using to fund long-term training in the United States, university education for Indonesians. I spent 18 years in the Treasury Department, and the last three were actually in the office, in an office called East Europe and Former Soviet Union Policy. And while I was there, we created an Office of Technical Assistance that became the Office of Technical Assistance and eventually even a deputate. And that was an absolutely remarkable experience. I have lots of stories I could tell you about that. I went to the private sector and worked at the absolutely stratospheric level on crisis prevention and resolution. And then I came to Brookings and somewhat surprisingly found myself doing a study of the off-budget funding of the military in Indonesia, which is a very interesting aspect of public finance, off-budget funding. And that was followed up by a study I completed that came out just last month when I was in Jakarta, looking at government foundations in Indonesia. These are absolutely unique. I don't think there's any country in the world that has government foundations attached to foundations attached to the ministries and agencies of the central government that exist for the purpose of the welfare of the employees of those ministries and agencies. But my current research interest is Myanmar, Burma, which happens to have the world's longest continuing civil war. This is definitely a conflict situation, a conflict-affected country, and the work I'm doing is very much centered on the economic dimension of what's going on there, and that, of course, includes public financial management. I want to zip through some remarks I had semi-prepared and try to get quickly to the recommendations that Raymond mentioned earlier. I did want to speak briefly about how finance is special when you look at the big picture. It's not like other sectors. I would also say, above all, in conflict-affected states, the most important thing at the beginning is to have good money. And here I would agree with Andrew, who said it's important to start with the central bank, because it's very hard to do anything in a country that doesn't have good money, and of course that's the responsibility of the central bank. But I would, for this reason, I would argue that it's useful to adopt a broad definition of public financial management. The narrow definition of public financial management would focus very much on the budget. Yes, this is at the heart of it. But it seems to me, especially in conflict-affected states, it's very important to include macro policies, which of course include monetary policy as well as fiscal policy, and it's very important to include the financial system, which includes the plumbing features that people have alluded to that are critically important. I would stress the role of the finance minister. The finance minister is different. One of the reasons why the finance minister is different is that it's the institutional responsibility of that person to say no. It's the only minister who sort of has a mandate to say no. All of the other ministers are trying to spend more. There is no other minister whose job it is to stop spending, and that's one of the reasons why this position is so important. I wanted to say a few things about why conflict-affected states are different from other countries where bilateral and multilateral donors may provide technical assistance for public financial management. We can think of cases like East Europe, and I would put Indonesia in the same category. East Europe in the 1990s, coming out of a system of central planning, moving toward a more market-based system. Thinking of Indonesia in 1998, when it ended 30 years of authoritarian rule and moved to democracy. But in both of these situations, there was basic law and order. There was not a security issue. By contrast, if you're talking about countries like Zimbabwe or the Democratic Republic of the Congo or Myanmar, of course, Sudan, Somalia, and a number of other countries, not to mention Afghanistan and Iraq, security is a critical issue, and this has important, I would say, huge implications for what one does in the area of public financial management. I thought I would speak a little bit about the fascinating case of Indonesia. I really don't have as much time as I would like to devote to this, but I would mention three features. One is that the resource curse. I think in quite a few of the conflict-affected states that we face now, there is a real resource curse, and that needs to be factored into the strategy for helping these countries. Second, and of course, how this plays out in Indonesia is illustrative and interesting. In the case of Indonesia, there was an unprecedented decentralization 3 years after the transition to democracy. Government authority was delegated sort of two levels down, past the provinces to districts and to cities. And this was, I believe, critical to the success of the transition so far, and perhaps has some important lessons in other places. Finally, I would single out the current finance minister, Shri Mulyani. She is amazing. And can a person make a difference? We've talked about some advisors. You know, it's important to have good advisors, the right advisor can make a difference. But my goodness, the right official, the right finance minister can make just amazing difference. And it's a great story about how she got there, and also sort of sad, sort of tragic aspect of it is how little her own compatriots appreciate her. For example, she spent 2 years at the IMF in the executive director position. This, I believe, contributed immensely to her ability to be an effective finance minister. But the voters of Indonesia hold this against her. They consider it a black mark that she worked in the IMF. They distrust her because she spent time in the IMF. And this is just it's a reality, but it's sad. And then there are a couple of other women finance ministers. Madame Ngozi of Nigeria comes to mind immediately. And so one of the thoughts I leave with you is maybe we need to work much more to make sure that there are women finance ministers in the future. Something for you to work on. Think about it, Raymond. Okay. I came here with 8 recommendations in mind. I've added 2. First of all, intervention. Let's not forget that what we're talking about is intervention. We're talking about outsiders going inside a foreign country and mucking around. And that seems to me, if we lose sight of that, we're going to end up with a lot of problems. Second, understand the culture that you're working in. There are vested interests, and if you go in to provide technical assistance to one of these countries and you don't understand the technical assistance, you're going to beating your head against the wall time and time again. Start early. I believe that in every single conflict affected state in the world today, it would be a wise investment of donor and other resources to establish working groups to begin thinking about the issues, the interventions that can be done effectively when opportunities arise that are not available now. I mean, to plan ahead, be ready when a new government, a change in regime, or the existing government says yes, we can do this or do that. Or, as in the case of Myanmar, there's a cyclone Nargis last May created opportunities, but the international community really wasn't ready to take advantage of those opportunities. I think we could do much more to be ready for those. Go multilateral. Where is Mr. Byrd? My experience has convinced me that the World Bank really is the institution that should be taking the lead role in the efforts to help these conflict affected countries get their act together and start growing as we would like them to grow. In the financial area, I think it's terribly important to keep the Treasury Department in the lead. To keep the Treasury Departments, the finance ministries, in the lead. There are pressures, for example, to have 8 agencies or foreign ministries, or whatever. And I think the skill set that is in it's not simply the skill set that's in the finance ministries that is important in the process of delivering technical assistance in this area. It's also the network. If you come out of a finance ministry environment, you can do things in one of these countries that you really can't do if you come out of a development sort of USAID environment. It's important to have a proper mix of long-term and short-term technical assistance. The pressures will be for short-term, but the results, I believe, the results over the long-term, the payoff, the bang for the buck, is always going to be with the long-term technical assistance. And when I say long-term, I'm saying at least 5 years. And really, I mean, in a conflict-affected country, as far as I'm concerned, any intervention effort that has a time frame of less than 10 years is probably not serious, shouldn't be really taken seriously. And I would say even 20 years, I mean, the proper time frame is really something like 10 to 20 years. And I say this to the World Bank. I mean, this is when you go into one of these conflict-affected countries, it needs to be with that kind of time frame. There are links to the private sector and to the NGO sector that are terribly important in this area. For example, in Indonesia, the work I did in Indonesia was supported by something called the Transparency and Accountability Project at the Brookings Institution. This is working to build in key countries civil society capacity to monitor the public sector, to monitor public financial management, and to put domestic pressure on the government to improve financial management. This is there's an organization I think called Revenue Watch that does things like this. So these are and bilateral, multilateral technical assistance perhaps could do more to build up and encourage these groups. There's something called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative that I think is critically important in some of these cases. My eighth recommendation is to beware of the exile community. Many of these countries have exile communities. I think one of the lessons we've learned in the last few years is that there can be some tremendous skills, technical skills, in the exile community, in the diasporas of these countries. But in trying to resolve conflicts and help countries move beyond conflict, the political baggage that these people carry can be a problem. Ninth recommendation, leverage the work with volunteers. I've done some curious work in the area of international volunteering, but you know, and this has something to do with the fact that I was a Peace Corps and volunteer in India in the 1960s, but I think the capacity to mobilize volunteers in a wide range of countries, especially from the baby boom generation, is one of the opportunities that is really untapped in the world. I mean, there is a deep pool of people who are willing to work in countries like this, and the difference between the 60s, when the internet didn't exist, and today, when it does, and I mean, in terms of the impact that a volunteer can have, because they go out there, they spend 6 months, they spend a year, then they come back, but then it doesn't stop. When I came back from India, it basically stopped. And how could I communicate with the people in my village, in my town in India? It was not easy. But today, you come back, you have, you could Skype, you can talk, you know, like that. What does it cost? Nothing. I mean, what a difference that makes. And that power of the internet, I think, is not being used. Finally, perhaps the most controversial point, there are many non-democratic paths to stability and prosperity in these countries. And I think trying to start to stabilize and help economic growth in these countries by sort of importing a democratic political system, a parliamentary democracy, for example, is not really the smart way to go. That in a number of these cases, it's important. The sensible, the smart strategy is to have what many people would consider an authoritarian form of rule, because there are guns around, and it's so important to demilitarize. At the same time, if that authoritarian government or leadership is to be effective, it needs technocrats. It needs people who have the technical skills. So it seems to me the formula is to marry more authoritarian forms of political leadership. I'm not talking about dictatorship. Please don't misread. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with democracy. Please don't misunderstand me. Remember, go back to the first point, intervention. We're talking about intervention. And we're talking about a long process of work, a difficult effort to help countries, which are often sort of artificial constructs. In the case of Myanmar, I could argue, Burma has never been a country. And part of the problem is that it isn't really a country. And so it takes a while to, it's going to take a while to bring peace, stability, and economic growth, economic prosperity to countries like this.
Thank you very much, Lex, and thanks to the panel for those excellent presentations. I think we've had a lot of focus on the importance and indeed the centrality of an effective public finance management system. It makes it, as Larry described it, it's a small wheel that makes the bigger wheels turn. It is very crucial for aid effectiveness. We also heard that there are no quick fixes, and as Lex reiterated, long-term strategies are the best. I think it was Bill who talked about the fact that the interests of both the host governments and the international partners are aligned in this regard, because an effective and efficient public finance management system shows results for the donors as well as for the host government. And we've talked about the importance of paying special attention to conflict-affected countries. Andrew shared experiences and the importance of recognizing the peculiarities, not just in terms of the actors and the institutions, but more broadly, the most appropriate policy framework that would allow effective systems to materialize. We do have a bit of time for questions. We'll take the questions in batches of two or three and allow the panel to answer them as briefly as possible, so we can probably get one or two rounds in. Please identify yourself. I think, do we have any questions? I see William, Jeremy, a third, and David. Okay.
Raymond, thank you. Let me begin by thanking USIP for yet another wonderful event. For Lex, would you expand on perhaps the possibility of the role of a bigger, better, bolder Peace Corps in the future? There's a movement out now to double the size of Peace Corps to 16,000 volunteers by FY11. Could you expand about the role of Peace Corps in the, especially post-conflict countries where you might see it possible?
Jeremy?
I want to sort of tease out what I think is an implication in the end of your presentations, but just see, try to make it explicit and see if you agree. William described argued in a number of places that one of the things that one of the keys to the success of public finance. The World Bank public finance efforts in Afghanistan was that incentives were aligned correctly. The bank's incentive to work with governments were aligned with the government's incentive to be strengthened, et cetera. And that contrasts with the situation in lots of other state building situations, particularly post-intervention state buildings, where incentives are not aligned well, where you have money to be international entity that is interested in spending their budgets as quickly as possible, which may be with the consequence of dysfunctional international support of state building. And we've seen this in lots of countries you can all think of. My question is whether whether public finance as a focus is not only a sort of technical policy importance, but really strategic importance, in the sense of what countries like the U.S. that are intensely interested in the problems presented to international security by weak states, and consequently very focused on what we can do to strengthen states, whether public finance can or needs to play a central role in the state building efforts, as opposed to some other types of assistance in which the incentives are not aligned in the way that Wayne described.
David.
I think that the experience of a lot of people who do PFM reform is that a lot of the energy and the resources are wasted because nobody wants to take on the issue of civil service reform. Mm-hmm. And whether the central bank is the right place to start, it tends to be one of the first places to start because central bank staff tend to be exempt from the civil service. And in areas like tax reform, there's not a functional civil service system. There's almost nothing you can do to improve the collection in an appropriate way. So I guess my question is, do you think that a time will come when donors, especially some of the big multilateral donors, will sort of take on this very frightening topic of civil service reform as a key component of PFM reforms and governance reform generally?
Okay, we have three thought-provoking questions. Start with Larry and ask each panel member to say to respond briefly.
I will not respond to the first question since it was directed to Lex, but only to say that I think there's an interesting conversation that I'd like to. I want to listen to Lex's thoughts on that, and an interesting conversation to follow up with you about that. I think it's very intriguing. I think it's an intriguing idea. Jeremy asked whether, if I got it right, whether we really consider public finance a strategic issue, and we, meaning the U.S. government, and can it, should it play a central role in state-building efforts? You won't be surprised to hear me say that I think it should play a central role. It's not the only role, by any means, but I think it should play a much more central role in state building efforts. I think Lex, and among Lex's points, there were a number that explain or address why that's the case. I love the point, and I plan to plagiarize your point about the specialness of the finance minister being the one who says no, and how important that is. So my short answer to Jeremy is that I think it absolutely can and should play a central role in state building efforts. I think an issue that's sort of associated with that is, to what extent is the U.S. government in our current efforts to better position ourselves to respond or to deal with state intervention circumstances, an effort that's being led and by the State Department, the coordinator for SCRF. I remember the acronym, and I can't remember what it stands for. But Reconstruction and Stabilization. A really important question is what kind of corps, the active response corps, the sort of ready to go within 48 hours notice corps, and a standby, a larger standby corps that could be deployed. You know, what are the skill sets that should be included in those core, if we think that public financial management is a strategic issue and it ought to play an important, if a central role, We need to make sure that those core have are comprised of folks who can do that kind of work well, or allow, or our, the overall game plan should allow for the provision of such such experts in other ways. I think it's still an open, very open question to what extent the SCRS team, of which Treasury is a part, will be it, will be the whole thing, or whether there will continue to be complementary mechanisms for providing that expertise. But so that's my short answer to Jeremy. David, it was really, I think your question was more directed towards the World Bank, but I'll just say that I think that's a really important issue. In Guatemala, here's one example. In Guatemala, the counterparts understand that this is a problem. And they're thinking about, you know, how do we do this? How can we approach this in ways that is not going to, you know, have a revolution on our hands from different ministries that, for one reason or another. And I think an interesting approach that they're taking in Guatemala, also in Honduras, is to pick a sort of a technical, not so high visibility area, and focus in that institution, the tax administration in this case, on civil service, sort of micro civil service reform, and get a good story going there. Demonstrate that it can work, that it can be done, and that it can have positive effects, and then try to, in a positive way, sort of infect, if you like, the rest of the civil service. And I think it's absolutely essential. Question is, how do you approach it? You do it with big, sort of the whole civil service at the same time, or do you have a more strategic approach? And I think that is one possibility that might work. I just want to say quickly that I very much agree with Bill regarding the whether going around the state institutions is a panacea for avoiding corruption. I agree with you that it is it's one thing to say that the existing institutions are subpar or perhaps corrupt. It's another thing to assume that by going around them and not investing in their strengthening, that life is going to be good. I also agree with you that it's not necessarily better or quicker to go around the state institutions. I was citing those concerns really more out of a sense of fairness to the range of arguments, but look, I am all about strengthening institutions so that you don't have to fall back on these other mechanisms. And Lex, I very much agree with you that a broad understanding of public financial management is appropriate. And when I said anchor and I mentioned the budget, absolutely didn't mean that the macro and monetary policy type things should not be part of that. In fact, in Iraq and Afghanistan, the first things that we did in collaboration with the World Bank and others and the IMF was to get good money, as you put it. And I think it's a currency exchange and focusing very much on laying the foundation for monetary policy that makes sense, which is another way of saying good money. So I very much agree with you.
Thank you.
The question on the Peace Corps wasn't addressed to me, but I'm going to make a comment on it, which is that the people who are willing to undertake Peace Corps type of work are a tremendous resource and provide a different resource to many of the other experts or volunteers who are deployed, in the sense that they're probably more willing to go to less hospitable places, and they're willing to go there for quite a long period of time. And that's in these very difficult situations, that's a resource that you need to exploit. The difficulty is that someone who's a Peace Corps type of person is not going to be able to provide very detailed advice on public financial management. They don't have the experience that a Treasury officer has. So as part of the solution, certainly, but as part of the solution. I very much agree that it's important to look at public finance management as central and to align incentives. That your budget is the most political document that you have as a company, as a nation, as a person. It is where you define what is important to you, because that's where you put your most liquid resource, your money. And therefore, focusing on that does seem to be the correct thing to do, and ensuring that the incentives are aligned there would indeed be appropriate. I'm not going to comment on civil service reform, because I don't think, frankly, I've got anything to add on that, but I just want to pick up Larry's point on and the point made earlier on going around the government. I don't think you can go around the government, and if you have an institution that you need to deal with and it's dysfunctional and there are people in that who are not giving you the right answers, I think you have to bide your time. We did a very interesting project with the Central Bank of Egypt a couple of years ago, where we brought in someone who had been managing state reserves for Latvia, so post-communist country. He was 30 years old, he was managing the state reserves, he was US trained, and the advice that he was giving to the Egyptian Central Bank, where there were some young city bankers and a vast bureaucracy of untrained people who'd been there for 30 years and weren't doing very much, his advice was, you cannot go around these people. You have got to find a way of bringing these people on board, because at some point you're going to have a problem or you're going to slip up and they will kill you. They will you know, have your guts for garters. So you need to bring these people on board. You cannot go around them.
Quickly on the Peace Corps, you'll find on the Brookings website a paper I did with the president of the National Peace Corps Association, Kevin Quigley, called 10 Times the Peace Corps. So it gives some sense of where I'm coming from. The sort of bottom line is that the U.S. should create a corporation for international study and service that is sort of modeled on the Corporation for National and Community Service, which does domestic volunteering. And I think you're wrong, Andrew, about the Peace Corps, because, I mean, in this concept of the Peace Corps, you have baby boomers who have all of the skills that the FSVC has and more. And the problem we have with the Peace Corps is that it isn't mobilizing these people. But now going forward, if the United States is smart and builds a kind of international volunteer program that makes sense, I think, to support our foreign policy and our national security, then we will be able to mobilize people with those skills. Very quickly on Jeremy's point, I glossed over what I called the three pillars of good governance, and this is about the role of public financial management. The three pillars in my mind are political leadership, sound financial management, and the enforcement of contracts and settlement of disputes. And it seems to me if you don't have any of these three pillars, you're not going to get to this objective of peace and prosperity. And finally, on civil service reform, I can offer the case of Indonesia. I can cite the example of Sri Mulyani, the finance minister. The World Bank is very much at the. You could argue that the work that the World Bank has been doing is absolutely hugely centered on civil service reform, and the spearhead for this whole process is Finance Minister Sri Mulyani, and I know the progress they're making. First of all, nothing happened. Basically, nothing happened in this area until she became finance minister. And what she has been able to do since then, with unbelievably little support anywhere else in the government, is phenomenal.
Thank you.
So. Yeah, I'll respond to the second and third questions. First, on the incentives, I'm arguing that's very important. I'm by no means saying they were perfectly aligned on Afghanistan. There was some good alignment of incentives between the government, by the way, who wants access to money through the budget. That's what they like, right? They can fund their priorities. And the World Bank, which has to fund governments, and some donors who've helped fund the trust fund, etc. But this $3 billion, let's say, of money that's gone through the budget over the last 9 years in Afghanistan is surely less than a tenth or maybe a fifth, maybe, of total aid of all kinds that has gone to Afghanistan. So the bulk of the incentives of the international community have not been aligned with you know, making government systems work. So I think that's important. But I very much agree that the better you can align incentives through actually changing behavior and institutional processes and as much on the donor side as anybody else is important. I do think a strategic approach to PFM makes a lot of sense, and I'll again advertise the working paper that came out in January on public finance, security, and development. It tries to develop those linkages. Now, one thing we haven't talked about today, and it was interesting, somebody was talking about the misalignment between USAID and Treasury. I forget which commentator was it. That, to me, is dwarfed by the SERP and some of these other and other donors, for that matter, providing aid through or related to their militaries. And I think this is, A, an unstudied issue, and B, the risks of misalignment and wrong incentives, let's say, where you're supporting a local district leader or militia person or anything. I mean, these could dwarf some of these other incentive problems, which are very real. So I just wanted to put that. I think it should be on the table, again, you know, if the relation between aid and short-term stabilization after conflict and all this. I think it's, you know, I don't see convincing answers on that, and it's potentially a huge source of misalignment of incentives if you have large amounts of money going, again, outside local or central government. On the third point, on public administration, actually a positive example was cited, which was very nice. Actually, the bank has, I think, over the last 10 years been a lot involved in public administration, and the record is failure. Now, the interesting point, I would argue, is PFM is useful, coming back to that, as a strategic approach, not only because it is of central importance and the budget is a central instrument, all that, it's also something where it seems we can do a little better. We know, it's not that we know everything, but we know roughly what it makes to get good money, which I fully agree with, and the Afghan currency reform, which I would slightly comment on, was against the advice of IMF, but the government led it and did it right, was tremendous. I mean, those kinds of things. So we have some lessons on PFM. We have some idea, at least, of how to start and get things going and make progress. Public administration reform, I think the bank's external independent evaluation arm did an evaluation of World Bank projects supporting public administration reform. And I mean, that's not to be quoted, because I don't know if the exact number is right, but certainly over half, and I think it was something like 2/3 of the projects were rated basically as having been unsatisfactory. And then you look at India and Sri Lanka, or you look at well-managed governments trying to do civil service reform, and they often fail, or usually almost fail. So I agree on the importance. I mean, and Afghanistan, the record has, you know, there's been a lot of World Bank efforts to support public administration reform in Afghanistan, and it was sort of nice that wasn't the topic of today, because I could be positive about the experience. The experience has been negative with some positive things. I mean, one way forward is what's called the asymmetric reforms, where you focus on a couple of key institutions, central bank, ministry of finance. There seems to be some progress there, but then when you go too far, or you expand it too much, or you start running into severe political problems, because essentially it means some agencies are being paid a lot more than others. So it's a complicated subject. I think I can assure you it's not for lack of World Bank interest and support that these things are failing. It's fundamentally seeming, you know, the political implications of PFM are there, but it kind of can be a bit under a technocratic guise, whereas public administration, you know, appointments, promotions, pay, all this stuff becomes an intensely political issue in any country. And I think, you know, so we need to do more there, but it's a hard nut to crack.
Thank you very much. I think if I could distill four main messages, the first would be the importance of recognizing the strategic nature of public finance management, not just in aid effectiveness, but also in state building. Second would be the importance of a long-term, appropriately sequenced approach to addressing public finance management. Third would be thinking about creative mechanisms to leverage skills and resources in donor countries. And the fourth would be the importance of coordination and collaboration. I think a lot of what we have said could be distilled around those four themes. I'd like to thank you for your participation, for your questions, and ask you to join me in thanking our excellent panel for a wonderful... Thank you very much for coming.